All right. Robert Borson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Scott Borson on behalf of Mr. Lyons. There are two claims at issue in this case, one under the Truth in Lending Act and the second one under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. I'm going to address the district court's ruling on the Truth in Lending Act. So the district court erred here because it interpreted a 1974 statute based on a 2009 amendment to Regulation Z. So what happened here was, if you look at the claim, the statute that we're worried with is 1666H, 15 U.S.C. 1666H, which is on its face pretty clear. It just says a card issuer may not take any action to offset a cardholder's indebtedness arising in connection with a consumer credit transaction under the relevant credit plan. So that statute was put in place in 1974, has never changed. And so what the court ended up saying, though, was that, and there's no dispute here. In page 11 of their brief, they admit that there was a credit card issue to my client for the purposes of drawing on this line of credit. So we have a cardholder and we have a card issuer, which matches. So the issue became credit card plan. And we said that the word credit card has a specific definition that the court should apply. District court said, no, when you add the word plan, it changes it. And I'm going to look at this definition that was added in 2009 that said it doesn't apply to credit plans or open-end credit plans that are subject to a home mortgage. That was wrong because, first of all, that addition in 2009 had nothing to do with the statute we're concerned with. What that addition was added for was because Congress passed a law called the Credit Card Act in 2009 that was implemented. That particular act added disclosure requirements for credit cards. What the CFPB did was, they went ahead and amended the definition of credit card to adjust for that particular provision. And when they added it, what they did was they said, this would apply, it doesn't apply to open-end credit if the home's involved. They added if the home's involved, and if you look at the rationale for that was because there were already existing disclosures applicable to home equity loans.
So counsel, yes. I agree with you that you know, in 1666, you know, we got to understand what credit card plan means. But as I read your brief, you're claiming that a HELOC is a credit card.
Yes. In this particular instance, Your Honor, it is credit card. Because
so you're actually not claiming that. I just want to.
Sure.
It seems to me that, I mean, I guess you interpret any device language on as including any credit arrangement, which I think is a, you know, if you want to advance that, you can, and we might embrace that, or we might say, no, that a credit card's talking about ways that you access a particular credit arrangement. It seems like the board, in contrast, doesn't take that position that a HELOC is a credit card. It says a HELOC is a credit card plan. And to me, those are different positions. But yours seems to be a HELOC is a credit card.
In this instance, there's no dispute that there was a credit card issued for the purposes of accessing this account.
Sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So, okay, when you look at the Truth in Lending Act, you got to understand it's primarily a disclosure statute requiring disclosures. There's also some prohibitions. So the prohibition here was specific under 1666H. When you're talking about that they take a different position, if you look, when they added that language in 2009, it was in response to the Credit Card Act, which was a disclosure act. And they had to adjust, and what they said was the reason we're going to exclude home equity loans from the operation of the new statute, which was 1666I-1, is because there's separate disclosures already required for home equity loans. Yep. It wasn't, there's nothing to indicate that they intended to undo the statute, or, and it would be ironic that a statute that they added that was increasing consumers' rights would silently take away another right in the interim.
So let me just try to see if I understand where we're going here. I understand the argument that this HELOC involves a credit card, and therefore the HELOC, which involves a credit card and discusses how that card can be used, is a credit card plan. I may agree with it, may disagree with it, but that makes sense. What doesn't make any sense to me is that a HELOC is a credit card. I mean, a credit card, the statute seems to be talking about as devices to access credit. The first point, whether it's a credit card plan in this case is an interesting question. And, we got an undefined term. Most of the time, the statute talks about what would be a HELOC. It is using, words other than a credit card plan. Now, that doesn't mean it can't still be a credit card plan, but it's using other words almost every time.
Right. And again, you have to take it in context. First of all, if you accept that, how the district court interpreted credit card plan was based on the definition that was added in 2009, which would mean if we filed this case in 2005, credit card plan would only have one meaning. And at that point, credit card meant that you have a device that you access the account. But
that could be wrong to rely on that regulation that came later. I get that. That could be wrong. But we also in the statute have that same terminology, both in 1637 and in the civil liability section. So it's not just in that situation. We have most of the time when the Act, forget the regulations, is talking about things that would be HELOCs. It's not calling them credit card plans. Now, I don't think that's the end of the question, because it might still be a credit card plan, whatever that means. I guess we'll make that decision perhaps in this case. But, so the district court could be wrong, but that doesn't mean, on that point, but that doesn't mean you win necessarily.
My point, Your Honor, is when you mention 1637, for instance, that's a disclosure statute. That provides specific disclosures being required when you have a home equity plan. It is not addressing whether or not they have the right to take money out of the account if the person doesn't pay. Okay?
Sure.
The same is true for the 1026.6 that the district court referred to. Those are disclosure provisions. And again, it's understandable that the disclosure for a home equity loan would be different than a disclosure for just another open-end credit. That's why there's a distinction. When it comes to disclosures, there's reasons to distinguish. When it comes to a prohibition, that's a basic rule that you can't take money from a debtor out of their bank account without any judicial involvement.
But it's only a prohibition if it's a credit card plan. So I think it feels like we're playing around on the fringes when the question is whether it's a credit card plan or not.
Right. And my point is when you're looking at the term credit card plan, first of all, I think it's sort of focusing on that and ignoring the first part, which says, do you have a card holder and do you have a card issuer? Again, we have a card holder. We have a card issuer. In this case, there's no dispute that there was
What if you had a HELOC that didn't involve a credit card? A HELOC is a line of credit secured by a primary dwelling. And unlike you allege occurred here and unlike the actual agreement that's attached in the record, it didn't involve a credit card.
Right.
So, the only way you could get it, you call up your banker, say, hey, I'd like $5,000 transferred to my checking account. Would that be a credit card account if there's nothing that resembles a card or a plate or something like that, like the definition says?
Yeah. Actually, what the definition says is any device, and there's cases that hold that even an account number can be considered a credit card under that definition. But if you're saying if you didn't have a physical credit card and your definition of credit card is limited to a physical credit card, then yes, the HELOC would not be covered by this provision. But we don't have that case here. We have a physical credit card even.
So that's fair. So the analysis would be, it seems to me, look at the HELOC, see what it says, rather than have some categorical rule that HELOCs are always credit cards or credit card plans.
I don't think you have to have a category. My point is, for the purposes of this, the decision by the district court was an error because, and I'm out of my time.
That's more my fault.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
You may proceed.
Okay. So the district court said, we're going to, and here's the thing. When you say the credit card plan has a separate definition. All that's changed is we add the word plan, and you're saying that changes the definition of credit card. We don't agree with that concept. I mean, the word plan is nothing more than just talking about, you know, the same as they could have said credit card agreement. The other thing is when the court, if you look at the court's opinion, they converted the credit card plan, if you're saying that's an important term, then she talks about the definition that she relies on that didn't come around until 2009, says credit card account. So there are different terms. So if we're focused on the word plan, she didn't address plan. She addressed credit card account based on the definition that was added 37 years later. So,
I
have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you do or what do we do with the fact that Congress gave the CFPB a good amount of discretion dealing with the exemptions of classes of transactions that may be necessary to implement the Congressional Act, taken with the fact that CFPB and its predecessor both define the relevant positions of the RESPA as excluding open-end lines of credit? What do we do with that? That they take that position.
Yes, and that's the RESPA issue. I'm happy to address it, but Mr. Robinson was going to address RESPA.
I'll wait for him.
Is that okay? Thank you.
Mr. Robinson.
May it please the Court, Philip Robinson. Judge Floyd, the answer to that question on our argument and what we presented in the briefs is below. Mr. Lyons did assert a claim under the regulations and the statute. On appeal, we focused on the statutory QWR claim, and we go to your question about the regulations, and the CFPB does not address the statutory claim at all. It argues, which we haven't preserved, I don't think, because we haven't advanced the Reg X notice of error request for information claim. We've advanced the RESPA QWR 2605E claim. So we think that yes, and we conceded in our briefs, there is some authority for the CFPB to exempt classes of transactions in regulations. Under Article 1 of the Constitution, there's no authority that Congress has to delegate to the CFPB to exempt from the statutory claim classes of transactions. And we know Congress did exempt certain classes of transactions in RESPA, 2605I2, that's the particular servicing statute at issue here. The GSEs, the Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and the other government entities, they're all exempted. At 2606, business loans are exempted from RESPA. So Congress has specific statutory exemptions for RESPA that apply to the servicing statute at issue here for Mr. Lyons' second claim, but Congress did not include HELOCs there. And we know from dozens of cases that we've cited are, you know, multiple, the Hillman, Reyes, Russell, Noah, a court like the district court below can't add exemptions to a statutory scheme. But we concede, Your Honor, they can't, that the agency does have the authority to adopt the legacy regulation that HUD had, exempting from regulations HELOCs, but the agency, no agency has the authority to accept the legislative power that Congress has enacted in the statute. So that's sort of our answer here.
If Congress, why can't Congress, you know, it may be odd, maybe, but there's lots of things that, you know, seem like Congress is, you know, delegating to agencies. And I mean, yeah, it just seems, I mean, doesn't Congress in 2617 specifically authorize the board to do what you say they can't do?
Right. 2617A is what you're addressing, right. Judge Quattlebaum, and that is dealing with regulations. It is authorizing like hundreds and thousands of probably other statutes. They authorize an agency to create regulations and rules. They do not authorize, Congress cannot delegate its Article I powers to an agency to create exceptions to classes of transactions that are in the statute that qualify. And we think the definition in the statute, 2602(1), of a federally related mortgage on all fours, there's really no dispute that a HELOC would meet that definition. And there are, as I pointed out, there are no statutory exemptions for HELOCs. There are statutory exemptions for others. So within the regulations, Congress basically made a policy choice. You agency, if you have too much trouble figuring out regulations that would apply to HELOCs, you have our authority in the regulations to exempt from whatever regulations we are broadly giving you to exempt out classes of transactions. So that's our basic argument here. And then more precisely, the other problem is with 2617A, at 2605, that's the servicing statute, J, there the authorization to the CFPB was regs to carry out this section, not regs to take away the rights given by this section. So there's two authorization statutes in play, and we discussed this in our brief, 2617A, which the district court adopted below, 2605J, which we point out has a different scope, and you have to read those together because they were amended at the same time in the Dodd-Frank Act. Congress didn't mean that one statute would trump the other statute. The case law has to be read together, and we cite the Buster case for that. There's a more fundamental problem with under RESPA for the HELOC issue is this is the judgment on the pleadings case. So the inferences are supposed to be in favor of Mr. Lyons. We're not going to argue today and go back to some of our arguments, but I do want to point out to the court, this is the second time this case has come up to the court. Before the first time, PNC filed verified answer. At paragraph 15 of its verified answer at JA11, PNC admitted without qualification to the basic premise. At all times since its merger with National City, PNC has acted as, quote, servicer of Lyons HELOC loan account pursuant to 12 U.S.C. 2605, end quote. It's very difficult for me to understand based on the pleadings that were before the district court to say that a HELOC is not subject to RESPA when the answer from the defendant without qualification admits that allegation. So again, for statutory purposes, we think we're on all fours for that claim, and we haven't advanced our notice of error and request for information claim that's asserted in a complaint, but we haven't advanced those in a brief. We tried to, frankly, just try to make it simple because it's complicated, right? They did give some regulatory authority to the CFPB, and it's not our job here to make an argument about, you know, the policy choice that they've made that we may disagree with. The next thing is there's a split of cases. Our briefing goes through those. The circuit court or the district court below adopted what we call the minority cases. That's the Chamberlain line of cases. I don't believe there's any circuit court decision squarely addressing this issue. Does RESPA apply to HELOC? There's a Third Circuit case. I think it's quoted within the block quote on Hawkins that we have in our briefing. And there was an assumption in the decision, but this question really wasn't presented. So to some extent, it's a first impression, but both sides have given you all the cases. I think even the CFPB, there's a split. And I think you'll see in the what we call the majority line, the Hawkins line, the courts look to the statute. The statute controls, not the regulations. So the
the regulations have to be consistent with the statute, and here we haven't advanced our statute or regulatory claim. So we think the Hawkins line is more in line, and then we would ask that the court reverse the district court's ruling on the RESPA count. A HELOC squarely falls within the definition of a loan subject to RESPA. There are exceptions for regulations, but we didn't preserve that issue, so we don't think it's properly presented by the CFPB's brief, which doesn't address the statutory claim at all. And we don't think it's really, it's not clear to understand what the PNC's argument is, except that they think that the regulation can amend the statute, which that's basic constitutional Article I provision is the agency does not have the authority to amend a statute.
Should we engage in some policy consideration that, for example, in a HELOC, interest rates would tend to be lower than on a regular credit card, second, the rate of foreclosure by allowing that ability to get money from the other account would lessen the foreclosure possibility? I mean, aren't there really differences in the way that a home equity line works as opposed to a plain credit card that would seem rational and reasonable for supporting their position?
Judge Boyd, I'm going to address that from the RESPA perspective a little bit, and Mr. Borson might get up in rebuttal and do some a little bit more under Truth in Lending Act. That's a very good question. The ABA's amicus brief on behalf of PNC disclaims any argument about RESPA, but they spend substantial amount of pages talking about foreclosure prevention. What's the one statute that's before the court in this case that deals with foreclosure? RESPA, 2605K1C. And then one of the purposes is to protect homeowners from foreclosure. But there's no express purpose under the Truth in Lending Act for that. So we think we're on all fours that RESPA, and from a policy standpoint, our argument here and why that should apply. The court doesn't need to get to some of the and typically when I've been here in other cases, the court has tried to shy away from a policy choice that the court itself or the parties themselves might have made a different choice, right? We don't get to do that. The legislature made these choices. But we know from RESPA point of view, and I'll just sum up this way, the remedial purpose, the broad purpose, they use any to define any qualified written request, any federally related loan. We know the Carrington case says that's broad. The Roth case, the Renfor case, the Wirtz case, the Morgan case from this court, the Harrell case, I think Judge Quattlebaum was on, and again, the Carrington case talk about the broad remedial purpose. That's both statutes. So the policy answer is I think the statutes need to be read broadly, not narrowly like the district court did. Unless there's any other questions on RESPA, I appreciate you letting me go over a little.
Thank you so much, Mr. Robinson. Ms. Garla? Ms. Garlock, I don't want to put any extra pressure on you, but you're here as a friend of the court. And I want you to be friendly to the court and explain this with being equipoise and other in terms of give us the unvarnished best guidance as to what this law should be interpreted.
I will do my best to do that. May it please the court, Stephanie Garlock for the CFPB as amicus. To begin with the TILA question, there are two major points that I think help explain why TILA's offset provision covers the credit card plan here and why this is a credit card plan. First, when we talk casually about a credit card, we might think that it involves a very specific financial product that you might be familiar with, a card in your wallet accessing an unsecured and revolving line of credit. But TILA and Regulation Z don't take so narrow an approach under that statute and regulation. Credit card plans can govern lines of credit that are secured or unsecured so long as consumers can use a credit card to access them. As a result, a consumer account can be both a credit card account and a HELOC account. The two are not mutually exclusive.
So, counsel, does that mean we look to the HELOC plan, see if it involves a card, and talks about terms and how that can be used? It's kind of a case-by-case inquiry to what is involved in a particular HELOC to see whether it's a credit card plan?
I think that makes sense. I think that it might not require that much digging, but the question is whether there is this specific type of access device, and Congress made the judgment that those access devices pose particular types of risks. And just to give you a little bit of something to hang on to when deciding whether the credit card account here is also a HELOC account and vice versa, I think you can find this in a couple of different places in the regulation and the regulatory history, that something can be both a HELOC account and a credit card account, which would mean that it's governed by a HELOC plan and it also counts as a credit card plan. The first place is in the CARD Act, in the statute. The statutory term was a credit card account under an open-end consumer credit plan. And my understanding of PNC's argument is that they think that this is not a credit card account because it's a HELOC. But the regulations that the board put in place in 2010 would have been entirely unnecessary. They added that parenthetical saying not home secured. That would have been unnecessary if a credit card account already wouldn't cover a HELOC account accessible by a credit card. There are some other places in the regulation you could look to see that something can be both a credit card account and a HELOC account. For example, in that 2010 CARD Act rulemaking, 75 Fed Reg at 7678, the board said that an exemption would cover HELOC accounts even when they are accessed by a credit card account. A year earlier, in the 2009 rulemaking, the board wrote that an exemption would cover the following types of credit card accounts, and then parentheses, the first example listed is a HELOC account that would be subject to 226.5b, even if it's accessible by a credit card. That's 74 Fed Reg at 5335. And so I want to take, so both of those are examples where the board specifically decided to carve out HELOC accounts because there were alternate protections in place for HELOC borrowers or because HELOCs might pose specific risks. Generally, that happened at the application or solicitation stage, and the Bureau acknowledges that different rules have applied for HELOCs in those instances. But here we're in a world where there are no alternate protections for credit card borrowers who are trying to access their home secured line of credit. And the board and the Bureau have made clear that when the general terms are used, those generally applicable provisions should continue to apply. The board made that clear in that 2010 CARD Act rulemaking where they put in place the exemption that the district court relied on. And so the history that PNC tries to give you of different treatment of HELOCs is really just cherry-picked examples from those express exemption decisions. We don't have an express exemption decision here. And with my remaining time, I'd like to just address Judge Floyd's question about the policy concerns here. And this protection and the whole suite of protections that the Fair Credit Billing Act put in place for credit card borrowers do have a place for borrowers who are accessing home-secured lines of credit. For the offset provision specifically, you can just look to the justification Congress gave in the first place for the offset provision. HELOC borrowers who are using a credit card too might have valid defenses to collection, and that's why we want to have prevent the banks who happen to have both the credit account and the deposit account from engaging in self-help. We want to ensure that credit card borrowers are able to assert those defenses in court.
Well, let me ask you this. Has the CFPB ever released any guidance or rules that treat HELOC as an equivalent to a credit card plan? Have you ever?
So we've not had any regulation about the credit card, about the offset provision specifically, but I just pointed you to some places in the rule in where we referred to a HELOC account as a credit card account. And it's also true that many of the protections for credit card plans have applied to HELOCs that are accessible by a credit card. For example, until the 2009 rulemaking, so for many decades, the same regulations governed account opening and periodic statement disclosures for both credit cards accessing unsecured and home secured lines of credit. And then the other protections in the Fair Credit Billing Act, including rights of cardholders to bring claims against the card issuers, but limitations on those liabilities, that would make sense to apply to cardholders who have a HELOC as well. There are other provisions in 1026.12, for example, 1026.12A and B. Those have limitations on unauthorized issuance of credit cards. You also wouldn't want someone to be able to send a credit card unsolicited to a HELOC borrower that might be intercepted. There are also limitations on liability for unauthorized use. PNC hasn't necessarily gotten into all of the limits of its arguments, but it's clear that this suite of credit card protections doesn't make sense to carve out a certain subset of credit card borrowers just because of the type of credit that they're accessing.
Well, historically, though, we've treated credit card plans different from where people put up their homes as collateral for the money. I mean, isn't that a historical fact?
It's true that there have been express exemptions decisions made for HELOCs in certain instances, especially when it comes to application disclosures or because of the importance of protecting homes from foreclosure.
But would a ruling in Mr. Lyon's favor unravel all that distinction, that historical distinction?
No, it would not, because when the board put in place or the Bureau put in place those distinctions, they were very careful to exercise the exemption decision and use specific language that would allow the exemption to be cabined to the specific provisions at issue. I know I'm far over time, but if I could just respond to the concern about the risk of foreclosure, it's also not true that removing the protection of the offset provision from credit card borrowers accessing HELOCs would necessarily prevent any foreclosures. Many HELOC borrowers will also have a primary mortgage. They might not have enough money to pay everything. And the point is to give consumers control over their deposit accounts so that they can pay their obligations as they think is appropriate. A HELOC borrower could be using those funds that might have been taken by an offset to pay their primary mortgage because they might think that there is a greater risk of foreclosure there. So it's not consumer protective to remove this protection for credit card borrowers accessing HELOCs. It would not necessarily prevent any foreclosures.
Yes, sorry.
Are you going to comment on the RESPA claim?
I'm happy to if you would like.
I would like to hear your viewpoint. It sounds like you didn't have any qualms with the district court's decision on RESPA. Mr. Lyon says that the statutory provision that allows the board to create exceptions doesn't permit it to create this exception for HELOCs. It sounds like you disagree with that, and I'd like to hear why.
Absolutely. So we agree with the district court and think that the court could just follow that reasoning, and we do disagree with Mr. Lyons' reading of both the extent of the exemption decision in 2617 and whether or not there's any conflict with 2605. On the 2617 portion, I think it's very clear just from a reading of the statute that the purpose of this is to allow, there's nothing in the statute that says those regulations can only alter other regulations. The purpose is clearly, and the text clearly allows exemptions from the statute itself. And we think that the case law that has grappled with 2617 has appropriately recognized that. I also don't think there's any conflict with the more specific regulatory authority in 2605J. There Congress was instructing that the HUD at the time and now the Bureau shall issue regulations, which really the regulations are necessary to make RESPA work. That's what people follow. There's a safe harbor for following the regulations. And so that instruction that you must issue regulations on this point and here's how to do it, you need to have the model forms in it, doesn't trump the general authorization in 2617 to make exemptions where necessary.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Levin.
If it may please the court, Frederick Levin for PNC Bank. Through amicus litigation rather than rulemaking, the CFPB has, in effect, invited the court to rewrite Fair Credit Billing Act 1974 and re- reverse decades of TILA's regulatory history. This court should reject that invitation and affirm the judgment of the district court because neither the Act nor TILA's regulatory history support the conclusion that a HELOC is a credit card plan. Congress used words precisely in the Act when Congress intended to impose a duty based on use of a credit card alone. It said so. For example, Section 1666E imposes a duty on a seller where a credit card has been used to obtain credit. In contrast, Congress employed very different language to trigger application of the offset duty at issue here. The trigger for the offset prohibition was not use of a credit card, but instead a transaction arising under the relevant credit card plan.
So, counsel, do you deny that Mr. Lyons was issued a credit card in connection with his HELOC?
The short answer is no. He was issued a credit card.
Okay. And do you deny that the HELOC describes how he can use that credit card?
The HELOC permits him to access his HELOC line of credit using the credit card.
In various ways, he can go get a cash advance. He can use it to buy goods and services directly, correct?
As far as I'm aware, there are no limits on what he can use his credit line to access. That is, he can use the credit card to access the line for whatever purposes he chooses.
And so I guess my challenge here is I don't really disagree with a part of what you say, which is that HELOC is known as a specific type of credit arrangement. And I don't disagree that, you know, that there's a traditional credit card arrangement might not involve a HELOC. But we have the challenge here of an undefined term. I mean, you talk about all the precision, and there is a lot of precision. But there is also not a lot of precision necessarily on credit card plan. And so I'm wondering why, you know, it would be perhaps wrong to say HELOCs categorically are credit card plans, but instead to look at the HELOC, and if it involves the issuance of what you conceive to be a credit card, and if it has some terms and conditions on the use of that card, what's the argument that that doesn't fall under a credit card plan?
Because whatever the history of TILA regulation, well, I'll give you a couple of points. The first point is from the language I just read to you from the Act, the 74 Act, in which the offset prohibition was enacted. The language makes clear that use alone is not the trigger. Credit card access is not the trigger for the offset prohibition. What's the trigger is a credit card plan. In 1974, before 1974, when the offset prohibition was enacted, by regulation, the board clarified that an open-end real estate mortgage, a home secured product, would not be regulated as open-end credit. So at the time Congress passed the bill, credit card plan, which is the quintessential form of open-end credit, would not have been covered by the Act. So there's another indication of legislative intent. But then when you look at the history of regulation under TILA and Regulation C for 40 years when TILA and the offset prohibition coexisted, there's not a single example of the offset prohibition being applied to a HELOC. That's point one. Two, I think Ms. Barlett just acknowledged there's no regulation specifically applying the offset to a HELOC. And then when you look at the conduct of the Federal Reserve Board, every time the board addressed whether a credit card access feature changed the fundamental character of a HELOC such that it should be regulated as a credit card plan, it answered that question with the resounding no. And the, we heard talk about the Credit Card Protection Act of 2009. And the, and what happened in that is there, the whole series of new credit card provisions. And the board went in, changed the definition under TILA, and created a definition and expressly accepted HELOCs.
Why doesn't that undermine your position? It seems to me that when Congress passed a statute with some requirements and didn't want HELOCs to be covered, at least the board adopted a definition that excluded them. Yet it didn't go back to this regulation, to this provision we're talking about, and say, okay, there's this other place that we want to make sure HELOCs aren't covered by.
So there's two answers to that question. One was given by the Fed at the time it issued that statement, which is contrary to the suggestion that there was their argument is cherry picking. In explaining the what it did in 2009, the Fed stated that its decision was consistent with the board's historical treatment of HELOC accounts accessible by cards under TILA. So that decision at that time was not something about that act. It was in keeping with the general understanding that a HELOC is not a credit card plan.
But counsel, I know you got another reason. I want to let you use it. But it seems like, I mean, it's hard for us to interpret statutes by, you know, historical practices and what people said. You know, usually the best evidence of what Congress meant is what the statutes say. And so, you know, it feels, you know, Congress also uses open-ended credit cards secured by primary dwelling and uses that term. It uses it in 1637. It uses it in the civil action section. So it would have been real easy to exclude, you know, home equity type arrangements from that. And, you know, I get the argument that, yeah, we think of credit card plan as a traditional sort of thing, but I'm just having trouble seeing why you can't, why just because it, you know, just because that is often a different thing, it necessarily is if it involves a credit card.
So the reason is, and I understand that what the court is struggling with, but go back to the beginning of time in 1974 when this act was enacted. There is specific words in the statute that I read to you, which talks of where in one case the duty of that statute was triggered by use or existence of an access, a credit card access feature, and different language for the offset prohibition. So that tells you that use and access to a credit card isn't what makes the offset prohibition applicable. Also at that time, the board had already determined that home secured open-end real estate mortgages were not open-end credit and therefore would not have been a credit card plan. So Congress knew that the offset prohibition wasn't going to apply to
But I thought you conceded in your answer that this HELOC was an open-ended credit card, an open-ended credit plan.
It is an open-end credit plan, but it is not a credit card plan. It's a different kind of open-end credit.
But could, is it possible that there's open-ended credit plans and within there are credit card plans and under that there, HELOCs, but if that's a Venn diagram, at times there's some overlap. And this might be one of those times because it involves a credit card and an agreement that has some terms about the credit card use.
As a matter of pure syllogism, I think what you said is possible, but it is contrary to the history of regulation under Regulation C. Okay. There's 40 years of history where in act after act and regulatory rulemaking after regulatory rulemaking, the Congress and TILA took care to distinguish credit card plans and HELOC because they are fundamentally different credit products. And so the understanding when the offset prohibition was enacted was that it would not apply to this, to home secured transaction. The language in the statute points in that direction. The regulatory history points in that direction. And so what, and the reason you would say, well, why didn't they go and make a special in 2009 when they did the CARD Act, why didn't they go and take care of the offset prohibition? They didn't need to, because it was understood through 40 years of history and from the fact that that provision has never been applied to a HELOC, ever. It's not been cited by appellant. The CFPB hasn't cited an example. And if, so if you're, when you're looking at, and I understand it's kind of a new question, but you've got to look where all the pointers are indicating. Start with the text, then go to the regulatory history, then go to the statements of the Federal Reserve Board when they talk about why they accepted HELOCs accessible by credit card from credit card regulations. And they say it's because it's been our historical practice to do so. And they did it in time and time. They did it in 2009. They did it in 1989. So they're telling you that they're, and the reason they're doing it is because the statute, the products are fundamentally different. The credit card plans are fundamentally different. I think Judge Floyd mentioned the difference in interest rate. And it gives meaning to take into this account, to take this into account gives meaning to the concept of a credit plan. Credit plan is the constellation of contractual terms. And so the fundamental terms of credit in a HELOC are just different than in a credit card. The offset provision was intended to cover the situation where there's a credit card plan. And so the question that's before you is whether the existence in a HELOC plan of this is one feature of the totality of the credit arrangement, is this credit card access feature. Does that change the character of HELOC so much that it should be regulated as a credit card plan and fall within the offset prohibition? And the Federal Reserve Board looked at this time and time again and said no. It's an incidental feature. It doesn't change, fundamentally change the character of the line of credit as being a HELOC. So therefore, the offset prohibition does not apply, which is exactly the point Judge Gallagher was getting at in her decision and her reliance on what they did in 2009 and their explanation for their reliance.
But a HELOC is an open-end credit plan, isn't it?
It is an open-end credit plan, but it is not a credit card plan.
I understand that, but why is that not the sine qua non of it, the whole purpose? Is that that's the driving thing. There's an open-end credit, and the credit card itself, that doesn't change the nature of it, does it?
So that's an interesting point you raise, and I'll answer it by pointing you back to the text of the Fair Credit Billing Act of 1974. If you read it provision by provision, there are multiple layers of rules and multiple layers of triggers for the application of those rules in that act. Mm-hmm. So the act starts off with rules that apply to all kinds of credit. Open-end credit, closed-end credit, credit card plans, HELOCs. The rule about, and when the Congress intended that a rule for everybody, it used the word creditors. The duty was imposed on all creditors. Then you go down through the statute and this is response specifically to the point that you were making, Judge Gregory. There are sections that impose duties with respect to open-end consumer credit plans. And they use the word open-end consumer credit plan four times in four different provisions. Then come the two provisions about when use triggers application of the credit card. Triggers application of a duty. So the one I read to you earlier was when use of a credit card triggers the duty in question. And I distinguish that from the next provision, which relates to the offset provision, which uses very different language, which says the duty is triggered by a transaction under a relevant credit card. So the answer to your question isn't why isn't open-end credit just answer the question? It doesn't, because it's in the statutory language that makes those fine distinctions. And then, so the statute was enacted. It was enacted at a time when HELOCs didn't exist. And so, of course, Congress couldn't have intended HELOC to be governed by the offset prohibition. But there was a predecessor product, and at that time, called an open-end real estate mortgage. And by regulation issued before the 74 Act was passed, the board had made clear that that was not open-end credit, so it certainly wouldn't be covered by the offset prohibition to come. And to remove any doubt, immediately after the offset prohibition was passed, the board issued another regulation reaffirming that that same predecessor product, the open-end real estate mortgage, would not be considered open-end credit. So there you have all this evidence at the time that the offset prohibition would not apply. And then you have 40 years of history when it was never applied, and the board goes out of its way to distinguish at every rulemaking. And Congress, too. Congress passed separate laws dealing with credit cards and HELOCs. Did it in 88? Did it again in 2009?
But that may be true in terms of the way you winnow it down. Where does it, is a creditor, yes. Is a consumer? But the banking industry perhaps morphed itself into it by wanting to make these credit cards accessible to consumers. And then, you know, that acts like a duck and quacks. I mean, it is a duck. I mean, it's, you wanted credit card in to form to have the same access that it does any other credit card. And it seems to me it falls in the definition. It's an open end. It's wanting the consumer to use that plastic. The only difference is it's just this is going to be inured to maybe of adding the encumbrance on your real property, but it's a credit card.
The difference is in the policy questions. One is the credit card in an open-end regular credit card line, it is the essence of the plan. Here, home secured plan, HELOC, the access is an incident. Whether you use a credit card or you get a check, or an advance by calling in, as Judge Quattlebaum's suggested, the mode of access is irrelevant. The fundamental underlying question is what kind of credit plan this is. Does this have the credit terms and a credit arrangement of a HELOC, or is it the credit arrangement of an unsecured line, like a credit card plan, with a higher interest rate? And that goes to the policy question, right?
The trouble is that has some, you know, logic to it, but it puts, you know, it asks us, you know, I know you point to the text, but it seems like most of your reasonings are outside the text. And we're trying to look and see what a credit card plan is. I don't disagree that there's no way it would have been thought about in 74 because it didn't exist. I mean, but that can't be our rule.
If the understanding of a credit card plan is an unsecured line of credit characterized by a higher interest rate, different acts, different regulatory provisions mandated by TILA. The same is true with the HELOC. A HELOC primary characteristic is home secured credit, lower secured credit, and very specific HELOC disclosures mandated by TILA that are not mandated for credit card plans. For example, the requirement of a committed line of credit, which Mr. Lyons had the benefit of, which limited the circumstances under which PNC could terminate credit. So he had a HELOC plan. And as you pointed out, Judge Quattlebaum, earlier, if there were no credit card access feature, it'd be no question it's a credit card plan and the offset prohibition wouldn't apply. And the reason why the history is relevant, because every time when the question came up, the board treated that feature as an incident not a fundamental characteristic of the HELOC plan, because it's an incident, because there are other ways. For example, on this plan, there were two other ways Mr. Lyons could have accessed his credit line. So the question ultimately is the credit card access feature an incident or fundamental characteristic of the HELOC plan? And the board has consistently said it's merely an incident.
I got one.
More interested, you know, as a in answering this question, you know, based on the text, but so usually consequences are more Congress's business than ours. Sure. We say what the law says, but it just seems to me as a practical matter that that bank customers that have HELOCs. If we were to say this particular type of HELOC is a credit card plan, you know, the earth wouldn't crumble. That there's not, whether or not it was intended or not, if it falls within the definition, most people with HELOCs, you know, probably aren't subject to or are probably more likely to be, you know, paying their bills as on time. That's really irrelevant at the end of the day, but I'm just curious as to what's really at stake here.
Sure. So, I want to make two points. I want to answer your question. I want to make another point, which goes to whether how the court should look at it. So, when you look at the policy behind the offset prohibition, the issue was the agreement between the parties for a credit card is unsecured credit. And if you could use the offset to obtain secured credit, in effect, security that the parties didn't agree to, you'd be charging interest as if it was unsecured credit when you took security. The HELOC is completely different. The HELOC, it is secured credit. Customer is benefiting from the lower secured rate, and there is a consumer protective element, which is that where and this is the fundamental focus of TILA regulation of HELOCs, which is the foreclosure risk related to the borrower, and where you have the ability to use the funds on deposit to secure a small monetary default, you thereby head off the foreclosure path. So there are good policy reasons to treat them differently.
So that your point is that if we, you know, if the offset, it doesn't apply to HELOCs, then you're more likely to initiate foreclosure proceedings? Is that the point?
I'm saying there are often situations where it is better for the homeowner to be able to cure a monetary default on a mortgage that affects their home. That is a reason why the not applying the offset of prohibition to a HELOC is a
they can always do that themselves, right? If they got the money there and they're about to be foreclosed, all they gotta do is say, whoa, here's my money, stop it.
It prevents the path of foreclosure from beginning. That's all I'm saying. And so there is a consumer protective point. I would point out one other thing, just in terms of, again, focusing on the history and the understanding of the offset prohibition and whether HELOCs are credit card plans. The amicus brief pointed out, the ABA amicus brief pointed out, that when the Bureau took over reporting obligations under TILA, it's required by statute to report biannually on the efficacy of credit card plan disclosures and other protections, and it writes reports to Congress on this. When it makes those reports, it does not include HELOCs in those reports. It doesn't include HELOCs accessible by credit cards in those reports because it knows they're not credit card plans. That ultimately is the fundamental question here. It's from the beginning until now, everybody has understood that a HELOC is a separate credit product and not a credit card plan.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon. Mr. Morrison.
All right, so here's the issue. Historically, HELOCs have been treated differently because the home's at risk. So if you look, what happened in 2009, the only reason they passed that because they realized non-HELOC credit card transactions weren't getting the disclosures that they thought they should get. So they added 1666I-1, which gave disclosures. When the Federal Reserve Board looked at it, they said, we're going to exclude HELOCs because there's already, in fact, if you look at the federal regulation 74 FR 54129, they say there's existing rules already that cover that. So there was no reason. So really, we're taking a credit card act that was passed in 2009, which was designed to increase the consumer protection, and saying somehow it decreased the consumer protection under the offset provision. Doesn't make any sense. When he keeps saying that they've made distinctions. They made distinctions because the home's at risk, which means they always wanted them to have more disclosures if they were going to put their home at risk, as opposed to just an unsecured debt. The policy, this idea that somehow that we have to treat the homeowner like a child and you take the money from him because he might spend it on something foolish and lose his house. There's lots of reasons. I represent people. The idea that, you know, $500 is no big deal to people is wrong. If I have a homeowner who has a car repair for $500 or a HELOC for $500, and if the car doesn't get repaired, he doesn't go to work, he should have the right to make that decision. So he might pay a late charge, but this whole idea that somehow this is helping prevent foreclosures. Under my example, it ruins the person. It assures the foreclosure. They didn't make the car repair. They're not able to get to work. That's what we're talking about. And then on the RESPA side, that again is designed to have a way for a homeowner to question what they're being charged for things. How could that be a bad thing? Why is the rationale that we have to take that away from someone who has a HELOC? Why? It's no different. Every other federally related mortgage has the threat of foreclosure. So does the HELOC. But we're saying that they should be treated differently. There's no rational basis. And I think, respectfully, 2605, I think the reason Jay is there is to limit 2617. So a homeowner has the right to make a choice between what bills they're going to pay. They shouldn't be required to pay the HELOC because the bank happens to also have their hands in their deposit account. And second, there's no reason not to allow a person who's got a mortgage, a loan secured by a mortgage, to ask the same questions as any other mortgage owner. That's what 2605 does. That prevents foreclosures. There's no policy reason to stop foreclosures by not giving them the ability to ask information. So we'd ask you to reverse on both claims. Thank you, Your Honors, unless you have questions.
Question. Maybe kind of unfair because I'm asking you to get into your colleague's head or this other side's head, but what do you think that they see as a downside of excluding RESPA rights for these HELOCs? What's the downside? The other side. Not yours. I'm talking about their downside.
What's their downside?
Yeah.
Is they've made all these HELOCs out there with credit cards. And they've been.
You don't have to go back and give those disclosures, like sort of.
Well, they didn't give the disclosures, but more importantly, they took the people's money.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. What they're saying is that somehow this consumer protection statute should be interpreted in such a way that no other creditor would be allowed to do what they're saying they should be allowed to do, which is to go in. I mean, we have the whole line of cases, Fuentes, all of those cases, and those involved like W.T. Grant case involved where there was actually a court procedure for prejudgment attachments, and the court said, no, this is unfair. This is a violation of due process. That's what they're arguing for. We want the right to dip into the guy's account anytime we want. And even though there's a statutory provision under consumer protection law that's supposed to be read broadly, you should interpret it that it doesn't apply to us, because we have a greater threat to this particular consumer. We can take his home. There's no exception because they're a stronger creditor to basic due process.
I was thinking about, you know, because you try to, these cases, obviously we have to go by what the law is and that. You try to understand what's going on in the sense that if you're securing a home and these HELOCs, it's almost like you want access to what the, sort of like the credit card industry, because it seems sort of counter indication that you want someone who owes you money for their home. Why do you want them to encumber the home more with consumer purchases? Kind of interesting. I mean, you think like you want them to pay the mortgage on time. But why do you have this thing that you want them to add to that debt with consumer purchases? You know, and then you say, but no, we want to be able to have different. Yeah, I just, I don't.
Well, I mean, we watched, I mean, 90s and 2000, early 2000s, you saw the ads that they put the bank in the picture or your house in the picture as a piggy bank saying, go ahead and borrow against it.
Right.
I mean, the answer is as long as it's they're secure enough to think that worst case, they're going to get their money back. Why not? I mean, they sell credit. That's their business. Right. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But that's their business.
You jump
with
your credit card, you jump all the way in, not halfway in, perhaps.
Right. And you put your home at risk.
Right.
So if we were to rule with you, you know, perhaps what needs to happen before that, we come back and see whether the agreement and the deposit account was insufficient approval, or we deal maybe with the damages provision. There are a lot of issues, even if you're right here, still to come, correct?
Right, but I think here's the point. I don't think the deposit.
That's not even the force. I'm just.
Okay. I would just say the deposit agreement. I mean, there's very specific provisions on how they have to go about it. I don't think you can enclose it in the deposit agreement. For one thing, keep in mind under Truth in Lending Act, if you're taking a security interest, you have to tell them. So that deposit agreement would have to comply with the Truth in Lending Act, and it doesn't. But I don't think it would override the statute in any event. So, you know, that's.
Thank you, Ms. Borson. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor. We're going to ask the clerk to adjourn the court until tomorrow morning. We'll come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.